Welcome to episode 23 of Indestructible, Indestructible Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the United Kingdom. I am a contributing editor of Alborada and am based in Sydney, Australia. If you like the content of this podcast, you may want to consider supporting us on Patreon. All of our patrons are now receiving a small selection of references to articles, podcasts, and books, which deal with some of the key topics discussed in each episode. Another way you can support us is by simply sharing this episode and letting your friends know about this podcast. You will find us on Spotify under the name Alborada, which is spelled A-L-B-O-R-A-D-A, and on X and Facebook under Indestructible Podcasts. On Instagram, you will find us under the title Indestructible Pod. September 11, 2023 marks 50 years since the military coup d'etat in Chile against the democratically elected socialist government of Dr. Salvador Allende. With Allende's popular unity government destabilized by the administration of President Richard Nixon in the United States and Chile's local political right and business community, the military takeover, which was led by General Augusto Pinochet in 1973, resulted in a military dictatorship that lasted 17 years and saw systematic torture and thousands of civilians murdered and disappeared. While most Western governments welcomed the coup in Chile, inside the country, poverty rose as the country underwent massive amounts of privatizations of state assets. Names like Milton Friedman, a major neoliberal economist, Jaime Guzman, a hard-right constitutional lawyer and politician, and the notorious Manuel Contreras, head of Pinochet's intelligence organization, DINA, became widely known as being a part of or working with the Washington-backed dictatorship in Santiago. In contrast, during Allende's government, many Chilean politicians, intellectuals, and artists distinguished themselves as they worked towards Chile regaining control of its key national resource, copper. Names like Orlando Letelier, Allende's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Ariel Dorfman, a cultural advisor to President Allende, and the popular folk singer Victor Jara are just a few figures among many who were widely known inside and outside Chile during the early 1970s. Another important figure, but one which was less known publicly, was Beatriz Allende, who was one of President Allende's daughters and one of his closest political confidants. In a country where women had not played key roles in politics, Beatriz's story in Chile's history is important because she was not only a member of President Allende's inner circle, but was also a key figure in establishing links between the socialist government in Chile and that of Cuba's revolution. Beatriz, as we will discover in greater detail, was also crucial in the creation of the Grupo de Amigos Personales, Group of Personal Friends, GAP, who were Salvador Allende's personal presidential security team. In order to discover more about Beatriz's life, I recently spoke to Dr. Tanya Harmer, an associate professor in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics. She is a specialist on the Cold War in Latin America with a particular interest in the international, transnational, and global dynamics of the struggle. Tanya has written widely on Chile's revolutionary process in the 1970s, the Cuban Revolution's influence in Latin America, counter-revolution, and inter-American diplomacy, solidarity networks, and women and gender. Among several books, she is the author of Allende's Chile and the Inter-American Cold War, and Chile y la Guerra Global, co-authored with Alfredo Riquelme. Her latest book is titled Beatriz Allende, A Revolutionary Life in Cold War Latin America, and is published by the University of North Carolina Press. I now leave you with Dr. Tanya Harmer. First of all, thank you, Tanya, for joining us here at Alborada's Indestructible, Indestructible podcast. Now, this year marks 50 years since the US-backed coup d'etat against the socialist government of President Salvador Allende in Chile. Before we discuss the life of Beatriz Allende, Salvador Allende's daughter and one of the president's closest advisors, and the figure of your latest book, Beatriz Allende, Revolutionary Life in Cold War Latin America. Could you give us a little bit of background as to what Chilean politics and what Chile looked like during the 1960s, which was the era that led up to Allende coming into office, winning the elections in 1970. And what was life like for the average Chilean woman?
Thank you very much, Rodrigo, and thank you so much for inviting me on to talk about the book. It's a pleasure to be here and to be talking to you. I think when we're trying to understand what Chile was like before 1970 and in the years prior to Allende's election, I think it's important to note that there was a real sense of a need for change. Not only coming from the left, and of course Chile had historic and very strong left-wing parties, Marxist parties too, particularly the Communist Party and the Socialist Party, but also coming from a new force in the center, the Christian Democrat Party, led by Eduardo Frei. And although he later moved quite far to the right in the 70s. In the mid 60s, the Christian Democrats were really quite radical in comparison to what had been in Chile before. In 1964 elections, you had essentially a two-way electoral race between the FRAP, which was the coalition of left-wing parties, and the Christian Democrats. And what's really interesting about that election in 1964 is that the right were the traditional right, the conservative, the liberal parties, were nowhere in the picture, really. They had been discredited. There was a growing sense that the status quo in Chile was no longer credible or possible, that something needed to change. And we're talking about the years of the Alliance for Progress. We're talking about years when there's a growing sense that agrarian reform, for example, is absolutely inevitable and crucial. But we're also talking about times of growing access to education, growing participation in politics, not just from the traditional elites, but much wider growing sectors of society, and unionization. So also unionization, not just in urban spaces, but also rural unionization, which happened. I guess the 60s was a time of a moment of growing impulse for change and growing effervescence in kind of political society. It's also a time when you've got the influence of the Cuban Revolution, the War of Vietnam. So Chile is also kind of, Chileans are looking outside to other parts of the world. And it really became also a theater for kind of Cold War contestation. So, this 64 election where Allende lost to Frei in the end, a large part of the result of that election was to do with the massive intervention of the CIA undermining Allende. But it was also to do with the fact that the right, which was not even kind of running in the election, decided to ally with Frei and throw their support behind Frei. But in the Frei period towards the end of the 60s, I think there's a growing growing sense that the Christian Democrats had not delivered on the promises of change and reform that they had brought forward, that the agrarian reform didn't go far enough. There were those arguing it should go further, but also a real disenchantment among many at the propensity for the Christian Democrats to use force. To repress workers' movements, as happened in a very famous massacre in the El Salvador copper mine in the north of Chile, which caused a reaction among left-wing sectors. And just one last thing, because I've been speaking for a while and I'll then go on to talk about the women. The late 1960s was also, as happened around the world, a moment of university mobilization. So enormous reform movement in the universities, public Chile's universities, which drew in, huge swathes of young Chileans into the process. And I think we have to really position the 1970 election of Salvador Allende, you know, with this backdrop in mind, which is, you know, growing effervescence, a desire for change, and also kind of a radicalization, a politicization of Chilean youth in the 1960s. You asked me also about women. So Right. Let me just say, you know, it depends to a certain extent which women we're talking about. I'm not sure. The problem about thinking about the average Chilean women is there were such differences in Chilean society. Actually, the 60s had been a moment where women were playing a much kind of bigger role than before, perhaps in public life, or had for some decades. There was a doubling of the percentage of students, female students, who were accessing university, for example, into the 60s. But there was still, Chile was still a very conservative country, very Catholicized, conservative country in terms of gendered expectations of women. So you had more women going to university, but the expectation was they would become teachers or nurses or social workers. And Beatriz Allende, who is the subject of the book, wanted to study medicine like her father, Salvador Allende. And it was interesting that something I found out during the research for the book was that actually in the 60s, there still was a quota on how many women could study medicine in Chile. So they actually capped it at 15% because universities believed that women would study medicine, but as soon as they got married, they would drop the profession, and therefore it was a waste of training and resources to train too many women. As it turned out, the women who did train, perhaps Beatrice might be a kind of actually an exception, have stuck through and stayed in the medical profession. But there were those, still those kind of gendered expectations in terms of the kind of careers women could have. And in left-wing parties, you know, the progressive kind of the left, women tended not to be leaders. They tended not to be seen as the ones who would drive change forward. Women were very active in political parties, but they didn't necessarily assume leadership positions.
Now, before Allende comes into office in 1970, he had a family with Hortensia Bussi, and out of that marriage, they had three daughters, Carmen Paz, Isabel, and Beatriz. Tell us a little bit about this family, and why did you decide to focus on Beatriz in contrast to, say, Isabel, who has had a long life as a Chilean senator?
Yeah, I think on the latter point, there are a few reasons why I decided to focus on Beatriz. I mean, this book really arose from my previous research, which was a history of relations between Chile and Cuba. And Beatriz was such a central figure in that growing relationship between the Chilean left and Cuba in the 60s. And so she'd always kind of sparked my curiosity as to who she was, why she was so involved in the kind of Cuban internationalism. And Isabel didn't have a particularly kind of political role in Chile before the coup. She was a student, she was active in general in the Socialist Party, but she wasn't as kind of, well, certainly not involved in the kind of the links with Cuba or the links with kind of revolutionary internationalism. Her public prominence politically, I think, takes off really after 1973, and then obviously with the return to democracy in the 1990s. So for the story I wanted to tell, which was about this revolutionary left and also the Juventud Revolucionaria of the 1960s, it was really Beatriz who was the kind of the person or the window that would allow me to understand that kind of world and that history. I should also say it's perhaps easier to write a biography of someone who's no longer with us than someone who is still alive. And I think Isabel has, you know, obviously spoken to the press and the media. She is a public figure, but I think there are aspects of her life and her past which she's remained quite guarded about. I think, you know, we don't yet know, we haven't got archives or sources yet to write that kind of history. In terms of the kind of background that this family had, I mean, I describe it in the book as a really quite middle class family. They lived in Providencia, quite a public family in the sense that Salvador Allende had been a public and prominent politician, you know, even before he had children. And the children were educated in quite elite schools. They were educated first in a small kind of French school, and then in the rather elite right wing, in a sense, school Don Alistair in Las Condes, an English speaking school. So you have a kind of a kind of mismatch, well, not a mismatch, but a kind of straddling of different worlds that this family have. So on the one hand, Salvador Allende is in the Socialist Party. He's active. He's tours the country. He meets all sectors of the population. He goes to the poblaciones. He campaigns, and he often took his children with him. So Beatriz often accompanied him on these trips. But then in their other part of their life, they're also part of a kind of middle class, kind of professional class, with a lot of very close ties also with the cultural scene and intellectuals, particularly Hortensia, side of our family.
Now, in January 1959, a revolution took place in Cuba. You've mentioned that previously, and this sees the 26th of July movement come to power, headed by the lawyer Fidel Castro. By February that year, Salvador Allende, now a Chilean senator, traveled to the island. The visit was the beginning of a long relationship between the Cuban Revolution and the Chilean left. Tell us more about this relationship, because the next question is, I want to explore Beatriz's connection. So tell us more a little bit about this relationship.
I think there was a lot of interest in what was happening in Cuba in the late 50s, in the kind of insurgency and the war against Batista, but a great deal of uncertainty as to really what this revolution stood for. I think, you know, not only in Chile, but in the US and around the world, it was quite hard to pin down exactly what the 26th of July movement was about. I mean, we know that the 26th of July movement wasn't, you know, initially allied, although they unified towards the end of the insurgency with the Communist Party of Cuba, that this was a slightly different type of movement. But a great deal of sympathy was around for the 26th of July movement because of the kind of autocrat dictatorial regime that it was seeking to overthrow. So what happened immediately after the 26th of July movement triumphs is that Salvador Allende visits and travels to Cuba. And I think the way he recounts it later is really, he wanted to see what the revolution was about. He wanted to see who was Fidel, who was Che, what did they stand for? And from what he later recounted, I think, you know, for example, in the interview with Regis Debray that he gave later, but also in speeches, he came away profoundly impressed and profoundly inspired, profoundly excited about not only this a revolution against a dictator, but also a revolution that sought to bring about profound social and political change on the island. And this is still before the Cuban Revolution, you know, defines itself as a socialist revolution, but it did from the very early moments define itself as a revolution that wanted to address inequalities, wanted to look at education, look at land reform, and these things. So he returned to Chile, and he was one of many travelers between Chile and Cuba that took place in the 1960s. And it was really as a result of these journeys, these visits, that people really began to learn about what was happening in Cuba. And I've looked at the media press, and I've looked at you know, youth magazines, and there was just such an excitement and interest in this new type of revolution, this new type of political system on the island, with competitions in, like, I looked at Gente Joven, a magazine that the Juventud Comunista kind of put together in the early 60s, competitions to win a trip to Cuba to go and see what the island was like. Congresses and writers and intellectuals visited Cuba. And of course, you had Cubans also coming to visit, traveling around Latin America as well. One of the things that was interesting I found out was that one of the senatorial races that Allende campaigned for, he also took with him a kind of cinema screen, a rudimentary kind of cinema screen, a projector, in which he was able to show kind of films of the Cuban Revolution made by the Cubans, and newsreels that told people in rural areas of, you know, near Valparaiso what the Cuban Revolution was all about. So there was a growing interest and awareness. And of course, you have the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis, which did a lot to actually mobilize support for Cuba as a country standing up to US interventionism and imperialism, I think was really important. But the relationship develops. I mean, Salvador Allende was always a very steadfast supporter of Cuba. He never said that the Cuban Revolution's way of coming to power was the right model for Chile, because Chile had a different political situation. It didn't have Batista in power. It had a constitutional democracy. But he spoke in defense of Cuba against the, you know, in its kind of against the hostility of the US. And in 1968, when after Che Guevara's death in Bolivia, survivors of Che Guevara's column, the Cuban survivors of the column, crossed over the Andes into northern Chile, Salvador Allende, who was then very kind of senior senator, spoke up in their defense and accompanied these survivors by plane back to Cuba. Well, he actually flew to Tahiti, where they then flew to Cuba. But the idea being that if he was accompanying them as a public figure and as a senator, no, you know, the CIA or any hostile powers could not interfere and seize them or do them harm. So I think that, and the Cubans were profoundly grateful for that gesture of solidarity towards those Cubans.
Mm-hmm. Now, later, of course, that year, Beatriz herself traveled to Cuba. There she met Comandante Che Guevara and was present during the speech when Fidel Castro nationalized U.S. businesses. By the late 1960s, Beatriz is dating the Cuban diplomat Luis Fernandez de Oña, and is working to support a second insurgency in Bolivia headed by the Army of National Liberation, the ELN in Spanish. The first insurgency by the ELN was headed by Che Guevara himself, who was captured and murdered in Bolivia by the Bolivian military in October 1967. Could you elaborate more on this aspect of Beatriz's life? As you point out in your book, the ELN's supporters in Chile ended up playing an important role or an important part of President Allende's security team, known as the Group of Personal Friends, the GUP in Spanish. And that was something that I actually wasn't aware of. I've read quite a bit on this aspect of Chilean history, but I thought that was really interesting. So could you elaborate?
Yeah, of course. I think maybe one of the reasons that Beatriz gets involved in Bolivia and in revolutionary internationalism is that I think she felt frustrated by where her options in Chile, because after 1964, after Allende lost the elections to Frei, there was among, you know, particularly youth sectors of the Socialist Party, a real sense of disillusionment, a frustration that electoral politics would not bring about change in the way that they hoped it would, that there were always going to be, it wasn't necessarily a level playing field with the US intervention, but also that, you know, why wait around when you could do something straight away? Now, out of this, you get the creation of, for example, the MIR, which is the movement of revolutionary left in Chile, which looked at kind of extra parliamentary kind of ideas for change and kind of supporting revolutionary movements. But because she was Allende's daughter, Beatriz never felt able, or from my understanding, never wanted to leave the party that her father was such a prominent figure in. So she remained within the Socialist Party, but she felt constrained and frustrated. like so many of her generation, Che Guevara was a profound influence on her. And, you know, after his death, Fidel gives this amazing speech in Cuba where he said, you know, it's no use like crying over his death. The best thing we can do is to emulate him. Seremos como el Che. And Beatriz is like many who also wants to be like Che. And being like Che means being consecuente, which in the time in those kind of times meant being true to your ideals, true to your beliefs, and being willing to sacrifice your life, yourself, even for that greater good. And it happened that she went to Cuba with her father very shortly after Che's death, and actually in that visit is where she met Luis. But she instantly volunteered and said, look, how can I sign up? I want to be like Che. Where do I train? Can I have some, you know, guerrilla instructions? I want to be prominent. Yeah, I want to contribute. And there were a number of reasons why the Cubans were hesitant. One was because of who her father was and the fear that her involvement in revolutionary internationalism, guerrilla struggles might compromise his democratic position in the Senate. But also because she was a woman, right? Because actually, you know, the heroic guerrilla, the Che figure was very much conceptualized as a man, and women were to be trained in the rear guard, in logistics, in the urban underground, in intelligence work. And she asked a number of times, but in the end, they said, look, you know, you will be vital, but you need to stay in Chile. You can work with supply, logistics, arms, and radio signaling she was trained in. You know, her view, and I think, you know, what we now know is that Salvador Allende was more or less aware of what she was involved in, but also very supportive of the idea that in other places in Latin America where there weren't the opportunities for a kind of peaceful democratic road to socialism, violent insurgent means were necessary. And he offered support in various ways to what was happening in Bolivia. But she thought, well, in Chile, I don't see my way of being able to effect change, so I will concentrate in Bolivia. And actually, it is, you know, we're all fighting the same struggle in the end. This is one revolutionary struggle in the Americas, in the world. So, you know, if I concentrate in Bolivia, that's, I can have my more impact. She wasn't very, she was very skeptical also of the elections coming up in 1970. She didn't have a huge degree of faith that her father would be successful or that the Unidad Popular could gain, could win. But a couple of things happened in 1970, and one of them is that, I mean, the Bolivian operation, the second ELN venture, unraveled very quickly. There was an enormous amount of training and preparation went into it, but a number of people were discovered by the security services. There were some intelligence kind of lapses, and there were divisions and splits within the ELN that caused it to unravel quite disastrously, actually, in 70. And you had some Chileans actually withdrawing from the ELN before Teo Ponte, before they actually launched the insurgency. And the other thing was that her father became ill on the campaign trail, and out of loyalty to her father, she stepped in and became much more involved in traveling with him. And when she traveled with him, she, and I've got this from the letters that she wrote to Luis, I was able to, Luis was actually donated these letters to me for the research of the book, love letters really, in which she said, you know, I was amazed by what I saw about the faith that people had in my father, about, you know, almost, she talks about a visit to the north where she saw people with posters of Che Guevara in you know, small, very small houses, you know, rural houses, and about the faith people had in the UP as a transformative project that could really have a make a difference. And she became increasingly committed and interested in the Unidad Popular. But she also was very worried about her father because she saw that he was perhaps I don't know whether she would have used the word naive, but he wasn't aware of the dangers or the risks, the threats against him, about the people who were mobilizing against him. And particularly because of her training in security and intelligence that she'd had in Cuba in the 60s, she saw the vulnerabilities that her father had on the campaign trail. And she persuaded her father to start thinking about, you know, a personalized bodyguard or an escort, as we would expect for presidential candidates today, but was perhaps unusual. And because Allende had been a very public politician, he traveled, he'd not had this kind of escort, he was initially very skeptical and said, you know, I don't need one, and why would I need one? But she was able to draw on very close, loyal friends that she'd met through the ELN to begin to offer him this kind of security during the campaign, and then immediately when he was president. And it was in a press conference, I think people said, well, who are these men standing around you? And he said they were my friends, a group of personal friends. So but they were chosen not because of they were a political party. They were chosen out of absolute loyalty to her, and because of her loyalty to her father. You know, these were trustworthy people that had the skills and the expertise to be able to support her father.
Let's discuss Beatriz's role inside the Allende government from 1970 through to September 11, 1973, when he was overthrown by the CIA-backed coup d'etat headed by General Augusto Pinochet. How influential was she inside Allende's inner circle?
I'd say very influential, but in a what I've called an offstage role or a behind the scenes role. Certainly not as a named participant in any advisory group, but more as a confidant, maybe, as a way to talk about it rather than an advisor. Someone that, you know, at the end of the day, I was lucky enough to interview Patricia Espejo, who told me, you know, at the end of the day of a long day working in La Moneda, you know, Allende would, gather his secretaries and others close to him and sit down and say, how did today go? You know, as you do with work colleagues. And they would talk about what had happened, about the challenges facing them. And Allende took his daughter's views very seriously. There was one reception at the Cuban embassy in which he joked that there were two things he feared was, you know, a reprimand from Fidel and a kind of reprimand from his daughter Beatriz. I think he took his daughter's views very seriously. She was a bridge for him to a younger generation of left-wing political active Chileans. She was also a bridge to the MIR. She had been at university with many of the leaders of the MIR when she was initially studying for medicine in Concepcion. And her views were a bit more, she was much more keen to confront, for example, the US when Chile nationalized, when the UP nationalizes copper. And there are anecdotes that, or people recall that she was cross that he even contemplated the idea of compensation. And she said, why do we have to go for compensation? So she would push her father to some extent on this idea of being consecuente, on kind of confronting imperialism or the US or so in that sense, she was in his inner circle, but she also, she set up meetings, she convened like advisory groups. She was there, you know, at his side throughout of the whole of his presidency. And that was one of the reasons when the coup happened, she was absolutely determined she would, even though 7 months pregnant, she would go to La Moneda and she would be at her father's side. And the fact that her father asked her to leave La Moneda, asked all women to leave La Moneda before it was bombed, was something that I think she never got over, because she had this profound love and loyalty to her father. The saying was that, and he, her as well, the saying was, and this gives you a bit of a sense of the gendered ideas of inheritance and political power in Chile at the time. The saying was that she was the son he never had. And I think for her, she was always aspiring to be that son, but as a woman was never quite able to fit those shoes. But certainly after the coup, many looked to her as kind of the heir to her father's political project and his revolutionary commitments as well.
And of course, Beatriz eventually ends up taking her own life on October 11, 1977. Could you tell our audience more about her life in exile, just briefly, her exile in Cuba, and how is she remembered in Chile today?
I think, you know, the parts of the book where I researched on her exile were just, I mean, there was an enormous amount of material and richness of documents to really delve into this, because, I mean, Beatriz was completely, as so many Chileans were, you know, defeated and traumatized by what had happened, you know, the death of her father, the death of so many of her friends, her comrades, the destruction of this political project she dedicated her life towards. But very early on, she dedicated herself to fighting against the dictatorship, of coordinating a global solidarity campaign. And she worked tirelessly on this project. By the mid 70s, by 76, 77, though, she was really, really depressed. She was depressed at the situation in Chile. She was depressed at what was happening to the left in Chile, which, as with any kind of, you know, the coup was such a devastating, violent act that the political parties, the Chilean political parties, had to kind of scramble to make sense of what had happened. There were divisions, there were splits, and she found it a very difficult landscape to navigate and to work within. So she was depressed and she didn't really see a future. She died of suicide in 77, which was maybe, you know, one of the lowest points for the left in Chile when it came to, it was a moment before, you know, the party started, you know, gaining forces again, before, you know, some of the resistance campaigns, the resistance strategies of the 1980s took off, before you had that groundswell of protests within Chile in the 80s. And also when Pinochet, the dictatorship, made moves to institutionalize the dictatorship as well. So this was a really, it was a very, very low moment. And I think maybe through researching her last days, but also understanding her exile, one of the things I came to understand, and I think one of the things I tried to get across in the book, was that the coup was not just had a violent impact on the political system in Chile, but also you know, had an enormous impact on the personal and human lives of so many people involved, that this wasn't just about the Cold War or systems or ideologies, but it was about people's lives, people's families, people's loves and relationships. And of course, she was one of those who, you know, with her death, her suicide, marks that, you know, just how dreadful and how impactful that coup was on the left, and those who had worked so hard for the Unidad Popular, but also the kind of revolutionary projects of the 60s as well.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Tanya Harmer, an associate professor in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics and author of Beatriz Allende, A Revolutionary Life in Cold War Latin America, published by the University of North Carolina Press. I really enjoyed your book, and thank you so much for talking to us here at Indestructible Alboradas podcast.
Thank you, Rodrigo. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible, Indestructible. Once again, I would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon, which you can do this for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any comments on this episode, please write to us on our email, which you will find on Alborada's website. We'll be back soon with episode 24, but until then, goodbye and stay safe.